Support for IPR and this podcast comes from the IMT Des Moines Marathon, October 19th and 20th, with 6 race events including the full and half marathons, marathon relay, 5K, and more. Register at DesMoinesMarathon.com.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, summer hoops. Hawkeye basketball star Megan Gustafson just started playing for the Dallas Wings in the WNBA. I'll talk with her. We'll find out about a 10-week-long summer basketball tournament that's bringing neighbors and law enforcement together in Des Moines. But we're going to start with the 2019 NBA champion Toronto Raptors. This is the first NBA championship for the Raptors. It's a huge win for Toronto, a huge win for Canada, and for Iowa. Raptor head coach Nick Nurse grew up in Carroll. He played for UNI. He coached the Iowa Energy, and he worked his way to the top. And Brandon Hurley, assistant sports editor at the Carroll Times-Herald, has been on the Nick Nurse beat for a year and a half now. He is on the line with me. Hello, Brandon.
Hi, how are you? Thanks for having me on.
Great.
I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you so much for being here. And before we get to the Brandon Hurley story, let's start with the Nick Nurse story, which I know you've been telling a lot lately. So we know that Nick grew up in Carroll. He grew up playing basketball and even showed an aptitude for coaching as a kid, right?
Yeah. He was always kind of the leader on a lot of his sports teams. He was the high school quarterback, and he was the point guard for their state championship winning basketball team. So he always had that natural leadership ability to him, and just from people that I've talked to and stories that I've read, that he was always kind of the guy that was steering his teammates in the right direction, kind of keeping them level-headed. And he was just always, from the coaches I've talked to too, he's always was a student of the game, and he really had that basketball IQ that people knew would take him far in his career.
And he played for the Panthers at the University of Northern Iowa, played for Eldon Miller with the Panthers, and then he joined the coaching staff there briefly, right?
Yeah, he was a grad assistant, and it was a heck of a year for to be a grad assistant. That was the year, it was 1990, that was the first year that you and I had ever won an NCAA tournament game, and it's actually one of the more iconic games. If you ever just watch highlight tapes of March Madness, you usually see a UNI player hitting a game-winning shot against Missouri, and he was an assistant coach on that team. So probably in the back of his mind, there was probably part of that that kind of kickstarted his love for coaching. He's like, wow, situations like this could happen more and more if I stick with it.
Right. Well, and he was really committed to being a coach, but that road was not easy for him. Tell me a little bit about some of the things that he did to stay in the game.
Yeah, he has one of the more interesting journeys to the NBA than of any coach that I've ever heard of. I mean, so after he went to UNI and was a grad assistant for a year, he kind of had a little bit of an itch to play some more basketball, so he sent out a resume and his highlight tapes around the world, and he got an interesting offer from a team in England called the Derby Rams, and they offered him a position to be player coach. So he went over there for a year, and he was only 22 years old at the time, and he was supposed to be the head coach, and he was supposed to play on the team. So he was out there coaching guys while also playing on the team trying to win. So that was pretty crazy. And then he came back to the States for a little bit, was head coach at Grandview for a year, was the youngest coach in the nation at that time in college. He was 23 years old. Then he coached a little bit at South Dakota as an assistant coach for a couple years. And then he decided that he missed being a head coach, so he jumped back over to Europe into the British Basketball League, where he stayed there for quite a while, probably about 11 years. He jumped around all sorts of different teams. I think he coached five different teams there in England, had a lot of success there, won probably over 400 games there, won a couple championships, was really kind of rising to stardom over there, really was one of the guys that helped kickstart the really popularity of English basketball. They got TV contracts over there at the time that he started, and there was all sorts of new arenas, new endorsements. So he was kind of that front line of that wave of basketball over in Europe. And in the meantime, when those seasons would end, he always knew he wanted to come back to America and coach. So he would come back to America in the summer and hang around different NBA summer leagues and just try to get a coaching job, even if it was a really low-paying job, even for a month or so. He really was dedicated to that. And
so he really wanted to get into the development league for the NBA. I mean, obviously with an eye on the NBA eventually, right?
Yeah, he always wanted to come back in the NBA. Just from talking to him, it started out as just wondering if he could do it, if he could coach in the NBA. And then obviously as he piled up more victories, he obviously probably built that confidence that, hey, I can do this. So what do I need to do to get to the NBA? Obviously, a lot of the coaches in the NBA you see today were either former NBA players or they have connections strongly to the NBA. But what makes Nick's story unique is he never really played professionally anywhere. He wasn't this highly regarded son of a former coach or anything, so he didn't have these connections to kind of go off of. So he had like as we alluded to at the beginning, he had to work his way up. Any way he could.
Yeah, well, and he got incredibly creative with trying to get that job in the development league for the NBA. I mean, basically, he created a team.
Yeah, he did. It's a great story. I love hearing it and love reading about it. He was in Des Moines one year, just visiting, I think around 2000 or early 2000s, and saw that Wells Fargo Arena, and it was right when it was built. So he hadn't been in it yet, but he saw it and he's like, hey, I wonder if there's a possibility for at the time it was called the NBA D League and now it's called the G League, but he was like, I wonder if there's a place for a D League team here. So he just cold called the NBA and they told him to look for some investors, and so then he located a couple local Des Moines investors. And then that kind of just kick-started the Iowa Energy, and they needed a coach. So they're like, hey, Nick, why don't you just be the coach? And he was the coach. And the cool thing about it was there's a lot of local there's a lot of guys with Iowa ties on that team. He had Curtis Stinson, who used to play for Iowa State, was one of their greatest players ever. He had Jeff Horner, who's from Mason City and played at Iowa. He had Adam Haluska, actually, for a few games, who's from Carroll. So there was that little connection too. And then with that, he had a lot of success there. He took them to a championship, and then a couple years later he went to the Rockets G League team in Rio Grande, Texas, and he won a title there. And then next thing you know, he's getting a call from Toronto to be their assistant in about 2013.
And then this was his rookie season as head coach, because the head coach for the Raptors got fired after last season, right?
Yeah.
Incredible. So I want to listen to Nick Nurse talking about all of these jobs, because, of course, this story has captivated not just Iowans, but people all over the place. This is a little bit of sound from a press conference after they won the championship, the soundbite from the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation.
Well, I would hope it inspires some people that are in those situations to keep working. You know, I always say that all those jobs meant the world to me at the time, right? Winning with Birmingham in 96, or winning with Rio Grande Valley, whatever year that was. And those games and jobs meant the world to me. And I loved all those jobs. And I think you can't do very good work if you don't love what you're doing.
So he still obviously feels really committed to all of the work that he did to make his way to the Raptors. His first season as head coach, I mean, what a dream season for him. When did you first start really paying attention to Nick Nurse?
Last year, about midway through the winter, I was kind of tipped off that he was going to possibly have a shot at a head coaching job. So I contacted Toronto and got a hold of Nick and drove out to Indianapolis for one of their games against the Pacers, and did a big feature story on him probably last February, and then just kind of closely followed the rumors around the NBA. And then when Dwayne Casey, their former coach, the coach of the year last year, got fired, the rumors really ramped up that Nick was possibly going to get a head coaching job for the Raptors. So immediately in my mind, I was like, number one, is this not only awesome for Carroll, Iowa, to have an NBA head coach, it's pretty cool for the state of Iowa. So I just really tightened my coverage and ramped it up. And then once he was head coach, And then they traded for Kawhi Leonard. I was like, not only does he have a cool opportunity to be a head coach, but he has a cool opportunity to go deep in the playoffs in his first year. So I just kind of went all in, and some of it maybe might have been overkill, but it's definitely been worth it to cover an NBA champion from Carroll, Iowa.
Well, okay, so writing for the Carroll Times-Herald and covering sports, I mean, your usual beat, I would guess, would be mostly high school sports in the area, right?
Yeah, it is. It's probably 95% of the time it's high school sports, so this is pretty big change. It's an exciting change of pace. Being a fan of the NBA myself, I jumped on this beat immediately. I was like, hey, I have an opportunity here to cover the NBA a little bit from Iowa, and if I have that opportunity, why not?
And did you get any pushback? I mean, you had to travel a lot. You had to be gone a lot to cover this NBA beat. Were there some questions about whether this was worth your time?
Yeah, it took a little bit of convincing here and there, but it was definitely, fortunately, my bosses, they understood how big of a story this potentially could be. And so I think that really hooked them in, especially if we have, there's only been one other Iowa native to win an NBA title as a head coach. So the rare opportunity of this whole situation, I think, really hooked everybody in.
Well, and you mentioned driving to Indiana in February of 2018 to go to the Pacers game to meet with Nick Nurse and to cover that event. That was just the beginning of the driving for you. I mean, I think it really tips us off to your commitment to this. Maybe obsession is actually a better word than commitment. What do you think?
Obsession might be a little too far, but I'm definitely very, very committed to it. I've driven to Chicago to cover a game when he was coaching against Fred Hoiberg with the Bulls. And then I drove to Milwaukee for two games of the Eastern Conference Finals. And then obviously the big giant trip to Canada, which was 28 hours round trip. So that got a little boring both ways. You hit about the 9-10 hour mark, and it gets kind of, especially because I did it by myself, so it gets really kind of boring and hard to make it through.
Right. Well, we are going to have to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment and find out about your time in Canada, your time in Toronto covering the Raptors as they won their first NBA championship. My guest is Brandon Hurley. He is assistant sports editor for the Carroll Times-Herald. He's been covering the career of Raptor head coach Nick Nurse, who grew up in Carroll. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Our Summer Hoops show this hour. Coming up in a few minutes, I'll be talking to University of Iowa Hawkeye basketball star Megan Gustafson about playing in the WNBA. We're also going to talk about the Summer City Hoops tournament going on right now in Des Moines. With me now, though, is Brandon Hurley, assistant sports editor for the Carroll Times-Herald. He has been covering Toronto Raptor head coach Nick Nurse pretty heavily for about a year and a half now. Of course, as Nick Nurse, who grew up in Carroll, Iowa, played for the UNI Panthers, coached the Iowa Energy as he took the Raptors to their very first NBA championship in his rookie year as a head coach in the NBA. So, all right, Brandon, back to your story. When you learned that the Raptors were going to the finals, I mean, you had to get credentials, and this is not the kind of story that usually someone from a small paper in Carroll, Iowa would be covering. Did you have to jump through a lot of hoops to even get credentialed so you could be part of this press pool?
Frankly, actually, I didn't really have to go through a lot of red tape. I had developed a pretty good relationship with the PR department in Toronto since covering several games in the last few years. So originally I wasn't planning to go to any of the finals games. I was just like, hey, I didn't think the Raptors would beat the Warriors, but with all the injuries
nobody
that they
did.
Had, no. Once all the injuries they had and they took a 3-1 lead and they were coming back to Toronto to close it out, I just immediately thought, hey, this is an opportunity that we may never, ever have again as a paper in Carroll. So I looked up flights initially, and it was like about $800,000. So I was like, that's a little pricey. I looked up the driving distance, I get a pretty good gas mileage in my Honda Civic. So I was like, 14 hours isn't too bad. So I sent an email out to the Raptors PR trying to request a credential, and they sent me to the NBA credential guy and typed out a pretty lengthy email for him. And probably 3-4 hours later, he responded and said, hey, we can credential you for Game 5, and if there is a Game 7, we can do that too. So probably 12-15 hours later, I was in my car on Sunday and heading out towards Toronto.
And you had a little bit of trouble at the border?
Yeah, that was those stereotypes about the customs are true. I'd never been to Canada before, so this was I was given my passport, and they didn't believe me that I was a journalist covering the Raptors. Everybody I talked to kind of was grilling me. They pulled me off to the side, searched my entire car, trunk, backseat, everything, did a background check on me. Granted, it was 12:30 at night, so that on a Sunday, so that might have had a little bit to do with it. But I was pretty nervous for quite a while. I was like, I drove so far to get here, and if I can't even get into Canada, this will just make everything worthless. But eventually they let me through, and I was on my way.
Wow. Well, and you seem to have kind of a special relationship with Nick Nurse. Tell me about that.
I wouldn't say it's anything too particular special. It's pretty professional. I wouldn't consider him a friend or anything of that business, but he gives me pretty good access. He's pretty friendly and pretty easy to talk to, and he's been willing to do a lot of the stuff that I've requested over him over the years. I think it's just it's part of his nature as an Iowan, is just to be able to kind of stick close to your Iowa roots. But yeah, I've been fortunate to talk to him a lot, and it's nice to have a guy, when you're asking a head coach of the NBA a question, to have him recognize you when you're in that media scrum and kind of give you a little bit of a shout out. So that's pretty cool.
So being in Canada, being in Toronto, you had never been there before, and you were by yourself. What was that like to be there for the championship win?
At first, it was pretty awesome. It was wild. The atmosphere was insane, especially because I went down to one of their viewing parties that they have right outside the stadium, since the Game 6 was in Oakland. So I hung around for that, and hung around in their Jurassic Parks, where they have that's what they call it, and they have a lot of giant big screens, and people are just everywhere. So it was cool when they won. Everybody was shooting off fireworks. There were red smoke bombs going everywhere, car horns and stuff. But after a while, it got pretty overwhelming because there was just so many people. It was probably several thousands of people at each street corner. And I was just trying to get the best feel for it. So at one point, I was in the middle of it all, trying to shoot video and whatnot and get a real sense for it. But being by myself, it kind of got nerve-wracking a little bit, because at one point, it was shoulder to shoulder, stomach to stomach, and I didn't know where I was. So at that point, it was already probably like 1 o'clock in the morning, and I had to get up at 6. So I was like, I should probably get out of here before anything gets too crazy. But yeah, it was definitely a moment I've never experienced before.
Absolutely. And so at least the CBC got pretty excited about having a small town reporter from the Carroll Times Herald. You got to be on the CBC on their morning show.
Yeah, the funny thing is, the Canadian press, they loved my story. I probably had 6 or 7 total interviews between radio and actual in-studio live appearances on TV. I think I was on the CBC TV 3 different times.
Wow.
And yeah, they loved, apparently Nick isn't as open with his career as he is here, so they just really wanted to get to know Nick's personality and what the path he took to get here. And so they thought it was really cool that a guy from Iowa drove all the way there to cover this moment.
Yeah. So, I mean, you're back in Iowa. And what are you covering right now?
There's still some residual effects of the Nick Nurse Championship. We've got there's an event this Sunday in Jefferson, actually, at Wild Rose, that they're having a big welcome home party for Nick, and he's going to be there. So I think that's going to be pretty crazy in itself. But after that, thankfully, things will start to slow down a bit and get back to normal. And for the rest of the summer, it's just baseball and softball for high school and probably random features that I can find. So it's kind of a drastic change from what I've been doing the last few months.
All right. Well, Brandon, thank you so much for talking with us. And I'm sure you'll stay on the Nick Nurse beat for the future.
Well, thank you very much for having me on as well. I enjoyed it.
Brandon Hurley, assistant sports editor at the Carroll Times-Herald. He's been covering Nick Nurse, who grew up in Carroll, Iowa, and of course won the NBA championship with the Toronto Raptors this year, his first season as head coach in the NBA. And now we're going to switch gears. We're going to go from the NBA to the playground, which is where it all starts for a lot of players. Last summer, the community group Urban Dreams partnered with other local groups in Des Moines to launch the Summer City Hoops Tournament. It's a 3-on-3 basketball tournament every Thursday night for 10 weeks, June through August, with the exclusion of the 4th of July, at Evelyn K. Davis Park and Martin Luther King Jr. Park. Neighbors are coming together. Police officers are honing their basketball skills as they take on the neighborhood talent. The lights are bright and people are having a lot of fun. Isaiah Knox is executive director of Urban Dreams in Des Moines. He's with me now. Welcome back to the show, Isaiah.
Hey, thanks for having me again.
Well, thank you so much for being here. And refresh our memory. What was the idea behind this Summer City Hoops series?
You know, we just wanted to find a positive way for young people in our community to interact with the community and police and have fun, and basketball was that gateway.
And it started last summer at Evelyn K. Davis Park. Tell me a little bit about the park itself.
Well, you know, the park is located on the north side of Des Moines, and for a long time it was considered one of the most dangerous parks in the metro, if not in the state of Iowa. There was just a lot of things going on there late night that residents, neighbors, police, community didn't want going on anymore. So we decided to program the park at night.
All right. Starting with one night a week. And tell me about your relationship with law enforcement. Why bring cops into it?
Well, you know, it's a mission of Urban Dreams to really have positive out-of-car experiences for police to interact with the community that they serve. We think that officers should get out of their cars, know the people that they serve, and that the residents should also have an outlet to not only have these negative experiences with police officers, but some positive ones.
Did it take a lot of convincing to get police officers to agree to play basketball in the park?
It took a lot of convincing of a lot of people in a lot of different positions to get the nighttime programming at the park. Some police officers were there right at the beginning. Other ones, once they experienced it, fell in love with the possibility and the programming and are out there every week now.
So it's every Thursday night. When do you start?
We start with basketball at 6. And then at 7 o'clock, we start with all the games, all the teams get registered, and then games start, and we do a double elimination tournament every single night, crowning a champion every single night, and then the last 2 weeks, we crown a summer champion.
All right, so you can win the week.
You win the week, exactly.
And can anybody play?
Anybody can play. We have kids as young as 5, 6, 7 years old, all the way up to adults. And when I say adults, I mean like adults.
All right. And do you break it up by age group? So kids are playing kids, or is it a kind of a free-for-all?
No, we wouldn't do that. We definitely break it up into age groups, and we try to make them as competitive as possible so that everybody has a good time and good experience and a lot of good games.
And these are 3-on-3 games?
They're all 3-on-3 games. Teams of 4, so you can have one sub, because games sometimes we go back-to-back and we go late into the night, so.
And who's coming?
You know what? A lot of people. We have hundreds of people every night, well over 200 every single night come out. And not only players, but the neighbors come out. Kids are coming out and watching games. Families are coming out and watching games, having fun. We actually, the first couple weeks last year, we had a hard time getting the food there, because we also have a barbecue. We do hot dogs and hamburgers and chips and cookies and all that stuff. Well, one of the neighbors was watching from their porch the first week, came out and walked around the second week. The third week, they said, hey, we want to do all the cooking for the program for perpetuity. So they've been doing
wow.
It every single week, coming out and feeding every single person. So obviously that has helped grow the program.
Wow, some incredible neighborhood support. What do the neighbors say about it? I mean, why would somebody want to do that? What are people in the neighborhood getting out of it?
Well, you know, people in the community, they're lonely. They don't know their neighbors. It's not a big community where people just have all these activities every night around to interact with each other. So this is a real way to interact with people and get people out of their house and, you know, stop people from being lonely and concerned with what their neighbors are doing in a negative light, but in a positive light.
So the sun goes down pretty late in the summer, but you decided you needed to play ball later than that. Tell me about your lighting situation.
Yeah, so that was one of the big initiatives. There was some money that came in from a grant, and they put out a survey and did some random canvassing and thought that they wanted to do some other project, sidewalks or bicycles or something in the community with the money. Well, a lot of the residents were like, you know, we want to be outside, but we don't want to ride bikes or we don't want sidewalks. We want to figure out a way if you could light the park. Well, there was, like I said before, there was some resistance behind that, but the grassroots effort of the young people and the residents really pushed the establishment to say, hey, maybe this is it. So we piloted it last year with some crank lights, and we cranked them up every night, and we left them there all week, and nothing happened to them. And then this year, City Council passed that we could keep that park open till 11 o'clock at night when it's programmed, 10 o'clock on every other night with permanent lights. And the lights are incredible. I mean, it's like stadium lighting out there.
Oh, wow. And so you mentioned, you know, the park was considered to be dangerous, and the neighbors didn't want to go out there. There were things happening after dark that people didn't want happening in their neighborhood. I'm curious, have you seen spillover? Is the park getting more use on other nights, the non-basketball nights?
The incredible thing about it is I get calls on a regular basis now about other organizations wanting to program the park at night. We have somebody that wants to do a Saturday night event now. We have on Wednesday night, they're doing a soccer on the basketball court night that's programmed by another nonprofit. So, yes, I mean, exactly what happened, or exactly what we wanted to happen has happened. So,
and for people who may not know about Urban Dreams and about other groups that are working in these neighborhoods, when you say programming, there are programs to try to engage kids during the day is what you were saying, but there just weren't evening programs.
Exactly. I mean, the original reason Urban Dreams was actually founded was to program after hours to six and beyond. So we just wanted to continue that and push other organizations to do it. We know we can't do it all. We have to collaborate, and we have to partner with organizations to get this done, all the way from grassroots to city to government officials and all that stuff, and business and industry to get it done, and it's happening.
So when you talk about programming, I mean, your focus has been on kids, but it sounds like it's working for everybody.
Well, you know, I don't know if our original focus was kids. You know, it was just for everybody to figure it out, a way, some kind of gateway. And basketball was it.
Do you have a favorite moment that you've experienced where you've thought, oh, man, this is working?
I mean, every single Thursday night that I'm out there till 11 o'clock, there's a new favorite moment when you just see kids coming back over and over and over again, adults coming back over and over and over again. But actually, I did just have a favorite moment from last week where we had a guy that played Division I college basketball professionally overseas, came in and was like, hey, I want to help this program grow. And he's now going to actually do some skill building stuff at the beginning at six with some of the kids that want to do that. So that's actually one of my most recent favorite moments.
Yeah, that is exciting. I mean, one of the things that I've observed, and many people have observed in recent years, basketball used to be kind of an equal opportunity sport. But with the growth of club teams and the summer camps and things like that, the kids that can't afford to get involved in those programs get left behind. I mean, this sounds like maybe a step in the right direction as far as being more of an equalizer for those kids that just don't have that kind of access.
That's the exact conversation we had in my office just yesterday. So you're right on point.
And tell me a little bit about how you see the relationship between the people who are participating and the law enforcement officers.
Oh, it's incredible. Like anything, at first there's some kind of a little bit of skepticism between everybody that's unfamiliar with anybody. But after you show up every single week and just keep drilling down to the, we're here for just fun, just basketball, just community engagement, it it blossoms into beautiful relationships.
Do you play?
I retired a couple years ago.
All right. Well, Isaiah Knox, thank you so much for talking with me.
Hey, no problem. I want to tell you one quick funny story.
Sure.
I actually worked with Nick and Brad at the Iowa Energy their first years here, and that's where I met my wife. So give a shout out to Nick and Brad and the Iowa Energy for doing great things for the community. So.
Oh, that's awesome. Isaiah Knox, thank you so much.
Thanks. Bye.
Isaiah Knox, Executive Director of Urban Dreams in Des Moines. Summer City Hoops continues every Thursday except for the 4th of July through August at Evelyn K. Davis Park and Martin Luther King Jr. Park in Des Moines. They've got lights so they can play late. Coming up in just a moment, I'll talk with Megan Gustafson, of course, standout player for the University of Iowa Hawkeye women's team last year. She's now playing in the WNBA for the Dallas Wings. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from the IMT Des Moines Marathon, October 19th and 20th, with 6 race events, including the full and half marathons, marathon relay, 5K, and more. Register at DesMoinesMarathon.com.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Megan Gustafson had an extraordinary senior year at the University of Iowa. She led the Iowa Hawkeye basketball team to a Big Ten championship, to their first trip to the NCAA Elite Eight in 26 years.
But for Iowa, the legacy of Megan Gustafson continues. For the first time since 2015, Iowa is heading back to the Sweet 16.
The Iowa Hawkeyes have done it. They stayed with it on the defensive end and got it into Gustafson on the inside.
24 points, 19 rebounds. Iowa advances to the Sweet 16 with the 68-52 win.
For the first time since 1993, the Iowa Hawkeyes are going to the Elite Eight, and they are going with perhaps the best player in the country, Megan Gustafson. They take it 79-61, 27 points, 12 rebounds, the 33rd double-double of the season for Gustafson.
And you have a post player that can command the attention of the defense and still be effective, like Megan Gustafson. And then you have a perimeter game, the supporting cast of four that can knock down shots. It makes Iowa a very dangerous basketball team.
She was named Big Ten Player of the Year. A video of her practicing a complicated drill went viral and inspired young girls and others all over Iowa to give it a try. And then it seemed like all of her dreams were coming true when she was drafted into the WNBA by the Dallas Wings. Then she was cut from the team, started making other plans, only to get another life-changing call taking her back to Dallas. Megan Gustafson is on the line with us now. Hello, Megan.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
Well, thank you so much for talking to us, and congratulations on being back in Dallas and playing in the WNBA.
Thank you. Glad to be back.
Well, let's talk a little bit about this roller coaster ride that you've been on, because, of course, after the NCAA tournament, then came the draft, and there was so much excitement about that. And when you got drafted by the Dallas Wings, tell me what was going on in your head.
Yeah, it was a super exciting moment. You know, obviously, it was quite the whirlwind right after the season ended. You know, less than 2 weeks after was when draft night was in New York City. And so, you know, it was a super quick transition, but, you know, all my dreams are coming true. And I just to hear my name called and, you know, I was so excited to be able to go to Dallas because it's, you know, a new place for me. I haven't really been there and, I was just excited to get out there.
So after the draft, then you still had to get through the end of the school year and graduation.
Yes. Yes. That was quite a craziness too, as well. You know, I took my finals 2 weeks early. You know, I was also traveling to other places, so I went to LA for the Wooden Award show directly after the draft. I went to Missouri for the USBWA Player of the Year banquet. You know, we had our own team banquet, and then I was training for a couple weeks before heading to training camp. So there was a lot that I fit in those couple weeks.
I'm sure. And I can imagine, I mean, after the tournament and then with all of those other things to do, Did you feel like your body was really run down at that point? Was it easy to gear up for going to training camp?
You know, I think it was, I was on a lot of adrenaline, honestly, and momentum kind of going into all of it. And so, no, I wasn't too tired or anything like that. I think I was just super motivated and excited to really start this new chapter in my life. And so I think that really helped me with that quick transition.
Training camp is an incredibly intense time. Tell us what it's like.
Yeah, definitely. You know, training camp is definitely a lot of long days, you know, especially as a rookie when you're trying to learn the system. And, you know, actually all of us were learning because we have a new coaching, you know, a new coach and a coaching staff here. And so, you know, we were all kind of learning together. You know, it's definitely different, you know, especially being an undersized post coming in. You know, I was kind of used to being the tall girl in the Big Ten, and, you know, coming here, I'm definitely not. And so, you know, I had to find new ways to score and new ways to, you know, just continue to stand out. And, you know, I was able to do that for, you know, up until about 24 hours before opening night, unfortunately.
Wow. When was the last time, thinking back in your life, when was the last time you felt like such a rookie? I mean, you were such a standout in high school. When do you think that was?
You know, I would say probably freshman year at Iowa, you know, at least originally coming in, just because there was, you know, a learning curve with the college level and, you know, all that. But, you know, with college, it's kind of guaranteed that you stay on the team. So I think it was definitely something I've never experienced before. And, you know, growing up in such a small town, there was never any tryouts or anything like that. So this is definitely a first for me.
So when you got cut, tell me what that was like.
Yeah, it was obviously one of the toughest things I've ever gotten through. You know, I just, to get your dream kind of ripped away from you and, you know, it's such a quick time. And then, you know, at first I was kind of in shock, so I didn't really show much emotion. But once I got back to Wisconsin, that's kind of when it started to hit me. And, you know, it was obviously tough, but it definitely motivated me on a whole new level. And I was able to really train hard just to see what was going to happen. You know, I had the TBT coming up. You know, I was hoping that someone would pick me up. But, you know, I was just ready for anything, and thankfully got the call back.
So you were going to play basketball no matter what. I mean, we've read a little bit about the plans that you were making in the interim, but it seems like almost as soon as you were cut, you started making plans and making connections.
Oh, for sure. You know, I definitely wasn't going to give up basketball as soon as I got cut. You know, it's something that I want to do long term, no matter if it's overseas in the league, you pick up. I mean, I just love the game so much, and, you know, I'm going to keep playing for as long as I can.
And then, so you're making all of these other plans, and you've got some good ones in place. How did you hear that Dallas wanted you back?
Yeah, so it's actually kind of a funny story. So it was on June 12th, and I actually had a tattoo appointment scheduled that day. It was my first tattoo. I got my favorite Bible verse, "I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me," on my spine, which actually kind of hurt. But, you know, I had that scheduled for that day. I had no idea this was coming. You know, I was just going to take the next day off to let my, you know, tattoo heal up and then, you know, get back to training, you know, in Iowa City. And so nothing out of the ordinary. And then not even an hour after I got back to my apartment from getting the tattoos when my agent called me and asked if I was ready to go to Dallas.
Wow.
And I was like, are you serious? Like, I thought she was kind of joking or something, but no, obviously not. And, you know, a couple days prior to that, my agent told me she was going to look into Dallas' situation, but I didn't hear anything back, so I really didn't think anything of it. And so I was definitely not expecting that call.
Right. Well, you'd already been on such an emotional roller coaster. I'm sure you don't, at that point, didn't want to get too invested in it again.
It was tough. You know, I think I've been through a lot in the past month or so. You know, something that it's been really challenging, but, you know, I've been able to trust it, and I just got to keep trusting it because, you know, nothing is guaranteed.
So you get that call, and they wanted you in Dallas the next day, right?
Yeah. I got the call around 8 p.m. on June 12th, and we booked the flight for like 6:45 a.m. that very next morning. So I had a matter of hours to pack and get ready. And it's kind of funny because, you know, none of the newspapers knew about it until after I landed in Dallas. So I had to kind of keep things quiet and kind of go through all this stuff. You know, obviously I told my close family and friends, but it was definitely kind of a crazy couple hours there.
I'm sure it was. Well, and did you get any sleep the night before getting on that plane?
Oh, barely. I was technically supposed to get like 4 hours of sleep, but obviously I didn't sleep very well at all. I was so excited.
Well, and when you got that call, your dad sprang right into action too. Tell me about that.
He did, yeah. So, when I got to Dallas, you know, that next day, they actually had a game. So I actually came. I didn't dress or anything. I wore my street clothes and sat on the bench. But the very next game, 2 days later, my dad drove my car. So he went to Wisconsin, drove his truck down to Iowa City to get my car, and then he drove 12 additional hours to Dallas to bring me my car. And so he stayed for Father's Day weekend, which is really cool. But it just shows, you know, how supportive and awesome he really is.
So he drove like 20 hours to see your first game.
Yes, it was pretty incredible.
That's awesome. So, I mean, tell me how things have been so far. I mean, you were at the training camp and then you were gone and then you're back and you're right into playing. So what's it been like?
Yeah, it's been really good. I think right now it kind of has a little bit more different feel than training camp because, you know, obviously, you know, roster spots, you know, everyone's kind of here and, you know, it's kind of more set in stone. And obviously we're right in the middle of season. We're doing a lot of games. You know, a lot of traveling. You know, I've already played in two games now. And so it's been really exciting. And, you know, I've been able to see the floor more and more each game. And, you know, I just can't wait for the next one.
How does it feel different from college ball?
Oh, it's definitely different. Obviously college, I was kind of used to kind of being the one people go to. But here it's so cool to be surrounded by such amazing, I mean, there's amazing talent in college, but to be here surrounded by such amazing people and teammates, it's really incredible and it's empowering, honestly, as a woman in playing this sport. Obviously the pace is quicker. The people inside where my position is are a lot taller, but I've really been able to improve on, my outside game too.
I want to spend a little bit of time talking about your senior year at the University of Iowa, which, of course, was such an extraordinary season for you and for the rest of the team. And, you know, in the spring, of course, when you guys were having your tremendous success, people really started paying attention and getting excited about the women's team. Outside of that, there are some diehard women's fans. I know it's really fun to go to the games, but women's basketball still has a really hard time drawing an audience and that kind of loyalty that the men's game seems to always have. Why do you think that's still the case?
Yeah, it's always tough to, know that, as a woman in sport, we're not going to be as, looked at as much, compared to the men. And that's the reality we face. And, unfortunately that's the case. But, I think it's been really cool to see that women's exposure has gotten a lot, a lot more and more each year. And, I was so happy that I was a part of the Iowa team this last year to really get people excited about women's basketball, especially in the state of Iowa. And, towards the end of my career, we had, the arena was pretty much sold out. And so, I'm so incredibly happy that I was able to do that and to really help further women's basketball.
Looking at your Twitter feed during the season, one of the things that was really fun to watch was how supportive the men's team and some of the players on the men's team were of you and the other women on the team. And what kind of support did you feel from the men's team?
Yeah, it's really cool. I think, Iowa Athletics has always been, super involved with each other. The men's team is involved with the women's team. They're super supportive of us. And so to be able to interact with them, all the time was really cool. And, it was just really cool, obviously to have their respect and we respect them. It makes for a really cool experience, especially because at the end of the day, we're all just basketball players and we just really love playing the game.
Somebody took a video of you doing the mic and drill where you're throwing up baskets with both hands. It's a great video. It went viral and it inspired a lot of people to make videos of them trying to do the drill. In particular, little girls all over the state of Iowa were trying to be like Megan. How did that feel when you saw all those tribute videos?
It was really special. All I've ever wanted to do is, again, to use my platform that I've been given to really impact people in a positive way. And, you know, I've been able to see, you know, little girls and even boys across the entire country, you know, emulating what I've been able to do, and, you know, to just dream big and to go after, you know, whatever they want to do. And, you know, I get emotional seeing those videos because I know that I'm making a difference.
When you think back to growing up in a tiny town in Wisconsin, who were your inspirations? What got you started playing ball?
I would definitely say my parents. You know, both of them, they played college basketball, and my sister also did. She played 2 years of college basketball at Upper Iowa University. And so, you know, just being able to be with them all the time. You know, I grew up with the basketball in my hands. I'd tag along with my sister and help them out with their practices. And, you know, they'd always encourage me to never back down from a challenge. You know, I'd always be playing up levels. So in second grade, I'd be playing on the fifth, sixth grade team. And, you know, my eighth grade, you know, you probably heard the story multiple times before, but, you know, my eighth grade year, I started on the eighth grade boys team. And so, you know, they've really instilled.
Because there just wasn't a girls team, right, when you were in eighth grade?
Yeah, we didn't have enough girls.
So who were, other than your parents, did you have, I mean, the WNBA has been around for a while, but it's not super visible. Did you have mm-hmm. women that you could look up to and say, hey, I want to play like her?
You know, so someone from my hometown actually did play for a couple years in the WNBA. Her name is Jolene Anderson. She played for the Badgers, Wisconsin Badgers, for 4 years, became their all-time leading scorer. And then, you know, she's the WNBA for, I believe, a couple of years, and now she plays overseas still. And so she was definitely someone, you know, I looked up to, and, you know, obviously her playing basketball, and I really like basketball too. So, you know, it's kind of crazy that two athletes came from such a small school,
yeah,
small town.
So I'm sure that a lot of Iowans are going to be watching the Dallas Wings now that you're there. But so far, what is your impression of the culture surrounding the Wings? What kind of crowds do you get?
Oh my goodness, the crowds are crazy here. I love it. The energy is so cool. I think if anyone would, you know, anyone from Iowa, if they think they've been thinking about coming and they don't know, they should really come, because the Dallas Wings fans are really awesome to be around. And, you know, we get a lot of people at our games. And so, you know, and also Dallas is a great area, too, to explore. So it's definitely a really fun environment to be around.
All right. Well, we will be watching and cheering from here for sure. Megan, thank you so much for talking with me.
Thank you for having me.
Megan Gustafson, she was named Big Ten Player of the Year for 2019. She led her Iowa Hawkeye team to the Elite Eight in the NCAA tournament, and now she's playing for the Dallas Wings in the WNBA. Talk of Iowa is a production of Iowa Public Radio. Our producers are Rick Brewer, Caitlin Harrop, and Dennis Reese. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. We had production assistance today from Camus Leeson and technical support from Julie Englander. You can get in touch with us anytime. Send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Follow us on Twitter @IowaPublicRadio. And you never need to miss an episode of the show. Please subscribe to our podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Just search for Talk of Iowa. This is Talk of Iowa. I'm Charity Nebbie.